Welcome to the API Resilience Podcast. If you've ever wondered what it really is we do when we do APIs, and if you've wondered how APIs change organizations, our communities, and our society, look no further. This is the podcast you've been searching for. I'm Christoph von Tomme, and together with my co-host Mark Bergauer and our guests, we explore how deliberate complexity, social practice theory, and a deeper understanding of socio-technical systems can transform our organizations and the world we live in.
I mean, you can look, for example, at something like XP or Scrum, if you want to, as a set of practices that have been connected, that some people experienced in some context as beneficial and then were decontextualized so that other people could try them. So I have especially really interesting conversations about people who picked up XP even before there was an agile manifesto. I'm still not quite sure how well or it spread. So I saw it in, I think, 2000 or something, just by coincidence, because a friend of mine, a university friend, came across it and said, oh, you're starting a software company. You might like looking at this. And if you look at the early articulations, it's actually literally a practice network that they're showing. And you could also, you know, in the same venue then argue, Agile at its early stage was actually an attempt of starting pointing out the social aspects of the work over the technical. So there are some technical practices in there that are specific to the software development, but even those have already a clear social component. If you try to argue for those, you will not get by just by technical arguments. Yeah, you already need some social aspects, or at least some psychological, as in, you don't know what the future is going to be, so whatever you're going to future-proof your thingy with now is just your personal concerns or your personal nightmares or history, etc. What we're trying to do is just almost removing the ideological layer that comes along with that, because we're saying, okay, we're completely context first. We're just giving you a way of starting visualizing things so you could discover, we could map XP, yeah? So when we would go to an organization, we would start with a practice network. You know, you wouldn't put things on a map before you go anywhere, because the mapping is then, so how are we actually coping with these practices? Yeah, how well are we doing? You could look at DORA as a practice network. If you look at the frameworks themselves, like XP or DORA, so then the people who were successful tell you roughly why they were successful in some organizations with it. That might or might not apply to your context. The important thing that you need to do is thinking about how, so we want to do, let's say, DORA type of practices. The way you are successful is to see what are we currently doing that is in that space, in the space of those practices. And then you can... So if you look at it through the practice lens, it becomes fairly obvious. So what can we do from where we currently are to be more like, you know, good CI, CD, continuous delivery, continuous improvement, et cetera, et cetera. So the practice lens in that sense enables you to have discussions that aren't belief system oriented. They're literally context oriented.
I think that's the main difference with any more traditional enablement or training program, because that comes in context-free, like here's all the things you're supposed to do. If you would be working with an API or like an organization, that's they have found a good meaning, they've found a good reason for doing APIs, they've already selected some tools, what would you recommend them? Like how would they go about developing the practices that could make them successful with their APIs?
So one of the things that we've learned a lot with maturity mapping is to really refine the context questions. Mm-hmm. The context you're asking there, I think, really quite big. Are you talking about the context of developers in a team developing APIs, or developers in another team consuming APIs?
So typically, let's see, what would be a good one? Most organizations we start talking with already have some APIs. They've got some apps. They've got some APIs that are serving those apps. They might even have some tooling available. Then somebody starts freaking out about governance and like, you know, we need to somehow make this more controlled or like a little bit more deliberate. Or there's a, you know, sometimes it's a big strategic question. Like we've seen that APIs are the next big thing. Like we really need to go and do APIs and then try to convince everybody. I think it's like if you're, imagine you're an API product owner, because I think quite a few of the people that listen to this podcast are in that space. So you own an API enablement team. You've just gotten the brief from your boss, like we're going to do APIs in a big way. Let's start a new team. We're going to become an API organization. Now, I'm not asking necessarily about this. I know that it's hard to say what practices they should do, so that's not the question. But yeah, like on a meta level, what is the first step that people, besides hiring you, of course, but what is the first step that people can take to start looking with a practice lens to things like this? So if you get this new big strategic initiative, how do you start getting people to have the practices and not just get stuck with a tool space? Is that a fair question, or it's still too vague?
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair question. I can have a good conversation about how that product owner might work with a team to start developing APIs. Because to me, there's potentially less social interaction with people who consume than there would be with users. But there is social activity, there's social practice involved in the case of APIs. So let's say it's a software team who are working with a product owner who have never deliberately developed APIs. Mm-hmm. They may have at some point, but it's never been a strategic thing to do. I think we'd be interested. For me, it always starts in, to use a term that Simon uses a lot with and worldly mapping, is develop situational awareness. Like, understand what are the practices that are in the context right now? What do people do? And we kind of do this in a number of different ways, depending on, I think the way I'm thinking about more recently is depending on how linear we believe the practices connect. So if the practices are a series of, we do this, then this, then this, then this, then this, we might have a conversation around those practices, like, oh, where do you start? Then where do you go? Then where do you go? And then develop a kind of understanding of the practices. Well, I guess one of the things we haven't talked about with practice that we think is super important for working out where there is space and where improvement can happen and change can happen is to say, what does good look like to you? Mm-hmm. So for every practice you do, like, what's your aspirations for that? If you could do that to the best of your ability, your team could do it, How would that unfold for you? How would you do that? And then with those pieces of information about practices, we can take a network of related practices and turn them into a map that shows how mature we are, how good we are, we believe we are at those practices. But in the analysis of those practices, you get to understand why you do them, what competency you need, and what tools you need to do them. In an API context, if you want to introduce APIs, there's different meanings, I suspect. You're providing a product to a different set of consumers. There'll be different competencies required around the design of an API, the kind of external facing aspects of a design of an API, how you version APIs. I'm trying to think, it's been a while. A whole bunch of different practices. So you maybe try to think about how those practices you want to introduce interrelate to practices that exist already. How would the testing practice change, for example? What new practice has to come into that network of practices that involves in testing? What practices are no longer needed? So you can have that purposeful conversation to say, right, okay, we don't need to do the, again, it's been a while, though to be honest, we never needed to do this. You never really needed this. The Selenium UI test, right? We don't need to do them. Thank God we can get rid of them, burn them in a fire, get rid of them because they're awful. Let's do, you know, our tests are, these are the kinds of things, the skills we need to develop. So it's kind of having that nuanced conversation around the various practices that currently exist and looking for the hooks in those practices for the new ones that you want to sort of mix in, to go back to Chemsys example.
I think that then, connected to that question, I think what I see people in that role most often struggle with is that they're working in a really large organization. There's some teams that are doing APIs already really well, or think that they do APIs really well. But it's a super heterogeneous landscape, and everybody's doing a bit their own thing, and there's a lot of resistance to change, because you know now these people come in and they want to change our tools, and it's going to just cost us a bunch of effort and not give us any value. How would you go about that? Like either harmonizing practices between teams or creating like a shared understanding of what are the practices they need to have. Like what would be, if you would try to help a budding API owner or an API program owner with the rollout of their program, what are the things that you would be able to do with something like maturity mapping and social practice theory?
So I would kind of want to start with what from the perspective of their experts are the practices that they expect to see mm-hmm. in teams who do this well, and use that as a way of having conversations with teams to say, tell me how you do these things, not to say do you, not to take an API practice and say how good are you at this, but to say what are the things, how do you meet the needs that these other practices purport to meet, and then from that have that understanding of their landscape with regards to these new practices. Then the conversation is depending on what needs to happen or what there's a desire to happen in order to become a mature team who do APIs, who develop APIs. It could be that the best thing to do with them is to kind of connect them to other teams mm-hmm. And have them share experiences with other teams in various different ways, whether that's, you know, a preferable way would be to actually work with other teams for a period of time to understand what those practices are that they do, and then they can co-evolve and co-develop those practices. Or it's, you know, maybe a depending on how the organization its priorities, its approach, whatever, it could be a coaching job where you go from team to team and introduce these new practices. If and Mark can talk a lot better about this than I can, if you have a team who do really good APIs or really good at doing those practices, and you want two teams that do those practices or three teams, you start by growing the team who can do it to a point in which it can no longer function well as a group, but everyone now knows the practices. And then you determine how you create two teams out of that one big team. What, how do you meet all of the needs that are need to meet through the practices? How do you understand how well spread those practices are across those teammates to then say, we now have two teams who can then do this work, and so on, and repeat in that way.
So I call that the mitosis approach. So if you look, so I'm a biologist, or I studied biology. Didn't work as a biologist, but I studied it. But it's an example from biology. How it's cell splitting. Yeah. So how do cells multiply? By splitting, and essentially they reproduce everything that they need. So they have everything twice. And at the point everything's working, have everything twice that's working, then they split. Yeah. And so I did this in an organization. So they had a good team that was working well. I can't take credit for it. The team learned that through other means. They had very good XP practices that were delivering great. So, of course, the organization gave them more and more scope, more and more people. But then at some point also because of more and more scope to product owners, and then the product owners got over time into continuous conflict because, like, oh, how do we determine priorities? And one product had more financial gain, so that product owner got almost preference, and the other product owner said, well, I have nothing to show for. So then the organization split the teams. At that point, they came to me because from having a good team, allegedly getting too big, so to speak, that delivered like 3-4 times a week, new features, new things, they had two teams that weren't delivering anything for 6 weeks. At the point, they came to me. And what went wrong is that the big team had a coherent set of practices that were complementary, yeah, multidisciplinary, etc. But they were coherent in that form, and then by splitting it, all the coherence was broken. And neither team had a full set of practices. So when we looked at it, so that was at the very beginning of our journey. And I said, okay, let's look at it through the practice lens. And it became immediately obvious to everybody why the two teams were dysfunctional. Because, oh, so expertise A, which is necessary, only exists in team one. And expertise B, which is necessary, only exists in team two. So then we brought them back together and actually focused on, okay, so who can learn missing practices? Yeah, so how do we actually get to the stage where we have at least two people who know every practice? Did this for 2 months. And essentially, yeah, intensive pairing and mobbing and et cetera to make these practices shared more quickly. And then we split again, and we had two teams that kept continuing delivering every few days. And then we did this again with both of these teams. So we put more people into these teams, made sure the practices were shared, split them again. We had four teams at the end of 6 months that were delivering several times a week. At which time, the politics in the organization changed, and we didn't keep growing. Yeah, so it stuck there. Or the organization didn't have more features to throw at that direction, at that part of the organization. But the practice lens made that really, really easy. And even so, if you don't want to do practice theory, yeah, if you, it's basically just like go ask people what they do, yeah, and then articulate the doings, not just the material. So, okay, what do you need to know? So in that particular case, for example, was literally, oh, I didn't know I need Jenkins. Nobody in my team has access to Jenkins. Yeah, it was this. One of the problems they had was as simple as that, but that wasn't seen as, oh, so there are some people that need to have practices around Jenkins, yeah? And nobody has learned these practices, and hence they've never been set up with a login. And
we often use in slides is work as a site of practices. It's not about the individuals and the kind of the view of who, it's a view of what is it we do, and understanding what we do. And that, I think it's a great example of what are the things we do that are missing, not who are the people that are missing.
So is there also a meiosis if you have mitosis?
At least since we adopted this perspective, I haven't consciously done that. So the mitosis approach was literally my thinking was informed by practice theory. And I believe we got out of this and got something working that was successful because of that lens. Now with the meiosis, that's more maybe in hindsight. So a precursor to, for me, for the practice theory was basically focus of interaction, especially cross-team interactions, so cross-boundary interactions. And so in a other context, essentially the problem that I saw was that the team formations that they had, the way they organized, was actually causing problems because it created boundaries that were hard to penetrate. So there were necessary, or there were interactions that would have been necessary for them to be better, but because of organizational boundaries, they were actually hard and either didn't or didn't happen to the extent or in the form they should have happened. Specifically, so this was a big end-to-end, so 150 people end-to-end value stream was really set up like in modern product thinking. But within them, they still had the segmentation into teams. And the team-to-team communication was hierarchical. Yeah, so it would only happen through, so senior people would talk to senior people. The practitioners themselves never interacted. And so what I did there was literally start breaking down barriers and created spaces in which practitioners would across teams. So so in hindsight, I understand, yeah, because they shared practices, or they shared at least they had connected practices as in inputs, outputs of their practices of each other. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what I enabled were spaces where they could talk about these things. And then that unblocked a lot of things within that end-to-end stream. So you could say that is meiosis.
Chrissy, because it's something very interesting, as you said, that we often, when things go wrong, we start looking for people that are missing rather than practices that are missing. And we go and hire someone who's got the right skill sets and who can fulfill a role. But that often does not work because they're coming from a different context, and this is well, that really piqued my interest, is that social practices don't happen inside of a single person. They're happening between people. Mm-hmm. Just hiring people is not going to create social practices. They might eventually evolve, but there's you can't just acquire a social practice. You have to grow it.
You could acquire people. That sounds horrible. Acquire people. You could you could hire people who have the competencies to recreate practice. But what they have to then be able to do is contextualize the practice in the wider system. And it's whether or not the system has the relevant meanings, has the dispositions, or you have the ability to practice to create, change the dispositions of the system. I think that's where it's hard. My go-to example always all the time is test-driven development. Test-driven development in an environment where there's no material for it. It's probably harder nowadays, but we didn't use JUnit, or we didn't use those tools would make test-driven development harder. Test-driven development where the meanings are of delivery are more focused on sort of the quantity focus over the quality focus. The underlying meaning that exists within the organization of the team makes that practitioner who brings the practices, it makes it harder for them to, I guess, introduce that practice and to practice that practice in that context. The integration is the hard part. It's like, it's no, I think there's any kind of silver bullet answer to that as to how, those practices can come in, but looking at things, if there is a desire for the outcome that these practices create, and then there is maybe a space to experiment to allow the new practitioner we've brought in to practice there to do those practices, use their skills, mm-hmm. then there's a space for maybe practice to start to grow and for new things to come in.
This is the other thing. This is the emotional understanding I got from Alicia's work, is that the good stuff is happening not in the constraints, but in between the constraints. And it's also the same thing. The interesting things that are happening between people is in the relationships between people. We have interesting people, but typically they're interesting because they have certain relationships to certain knowledge or to certain other people or certain practices. And I think that this is this not trying to reduce teams to individuals, but to see them as teams, as groups of coherent wholes, rather than an army of units. I think that's really important.
The way we are currently creating teams, even if we do dynamic teaming or so, is still informed, sort of top-down, goal-oriented. Mm-hmm. So you see this everywhere. Yeah. So the default thinking is essentially, if we want new things to happen, we have to start by changing the structure. Complexity theory will tell you that's just wrong. Yeah. Structures in nature are the outcome of things. They're not what makes the things happen. They then, as they structure or materialize, they then have a stabilizing effect. So not saying you don't need structures, but the mistake is that you start with structure. So when you say we should keep everything at the team level, that is too strong a constraint. In my view, from an organizational or point of view of organizing, how we're organizing, creating hard boundaries around teams is old school. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. still the traditional thinking. We might have improved a little bit in how we empower people to create those structures, right? Self-organized. Les has a nice little way of, so you need to, you have like 30 engineers and 20 testers and BAs, blah, blah, blah. You need to organize them into teams. How can they self-organize? And if that's what you need to do, then I think that's still a very good way of not doing it wrong. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not top down, allow people to self-organize. But the effective way is being led by what is current outcomes? What are your current strategic goals? Yeah. And the next decomposition level then is what needs to happen in terms of doings, in terms of work, to achieve these goals. Yeah. And then optimize that. So what you will need to have is enable relationships between people who can make these outcomes happen. And then the next thing is, so how can we improve that these relationships flourish? And only then you will start to see, so you need to get this underway and need these things to happen so you can observe, so how is this environment supporting this or detracting from it? And then you can maybe start to say, okay, here's a structure that I can see emerging that seems to support good things. Now I'm going to invest a little bit to stabilize this structure, yeah? Make sure it doesn't go away because of some budget cuts or, you know, things like that. But don't be too protective of teams. People also want that, yeah? So I have experiences, I've worked in organizations where teams have large-scale autonomy, yeah? The thing that they next complain about is, like, we don't have access to these people in this other team. That they want us to do things, or they need us to do things, but they just throw it over the wall, which the, hey, let's cheat teams as a whole has created.
How has Alicia's work influenced your work? Is there any practical takeaways that you've gotten from it that you're now applying? And for the audience, Alicia, we're talking about is Alicia Juarero, who was a guest on a previous episode, who should definitely go and listen to. So, Chris.
you asked me the hard question. I first get introduced to Alicia's work, I think, through a conference talk she gave in New York. I've not read a book. I have tried, but it's the first thing for me was it's not safe to fail. Sorry, not fail safe, but safe to fail. Mm-hmm. I think that was very interesting for me and kind of impacted or gave me a way of thinking about experimentation and work with that. Her ideas around constraints and context-free and context-sensitive constraints. I think. Again, my understanding of this is really, I believe, is very shallow. But I think for me, that helped me think about in practices, maybe what are the practices that create the constraints that enable us to be able to do what we do? What are the practices that, you know, keep the things together? I also wonder a little bit about the relationships with practice and the constraints that exist because of the relationships. Mm-hmm. So what are the material things that constrain our practice? Help me think about that. But I have to say that is possibly a better question for Mark than it is for me with Alicia. I know Mark knows Alicia very well and understands Alicia's work much better than I do.
Which is why I wanted to let you go first. So it's also very different between Chris's experience and my experience because Chris studied engineering and then became an engineer and then started to see, there's actually social issues that are just as important. But whereas I studied biology, so a lot of what Alicia builds on, I already encountered, read, tried to incorporate in my worldview before I met her. So for me, the reason why I point other people at it is, so she has this lovely quote that we're using all the time, meaning exists in the interaction of things, not the things themselves. Mm. By which she basically says, interactions, so start looking at interactions. Yeah, get away from the things themselves. Don't be introspective about people. So the way we're interpreting this, and I don't think she would fundamentally disagree, is if we want to make the work better, don't worry about the psychology of individuals. I mean, occasionally, yes, you will have individuals that need psychological care, as in they might be in some distress or some discomfort or some mental health issue. By all means, support them in dealing with this. But almost all the work issues are not due to psychology. They're due to interactions either not existing or being forced to happen in a way that everybody's uncomfortable with, so they're not effective. Etc. Just that simple quote, has I think echoed very well, for example, in lean agile circles. Yeah, a lot of people picked this up and started to, okay, we need to approaches very differently. And this is actually why Agile works so well, because it starts putting a lot more emphasis on interacting, yeah, and enables spaces for more interactions than we had before in the way we deliver software. And then the other thing is the constraint language that Alicia actually, and her forthcoming book, will be even more explicit on that, that she actually very specifically starts to explain how constraints work. Yeah, so how are they enabling complexity, and how do they enable novelty and stability in complexity to emerge, etc. And by using that language, we can start helping shifting how you look at things. We call what we're doing using a practice lens. Yeah, we're not saying everything you do is wrong and you have to change everything you do. We want you to look at it in a different way. And Alicia's language is underlying all of this by saying, here's actually how things in general, how complexity in general works. Here are some underlying principles, and giving us a language to talk about these. Even then, if some people take the terms and don't care actually what they mean and use them any way they like. But even in those cases, I would argue that they improve the conversation that you will have, yeah, because you start focusing on interactions.
I think what I find, I have a T-shirt with that on the back. That's one of my, one of my favorite phrases. I don't wish I'd, that comes sprung to my mind. But earlier on we were talking about how organizations act and how they look to change things because they see materials, they look at tools and they say that. I think the next thing, or one of the other aspects to look at, is that behaviors of individuals, and they think about organizational culture as an aggregation of these behaviors of individuals. We all behave like this. We're a big pile of people all behaving in the same way. So it's a people problem we have. Whereas what underlies this is the things we do and how we interact when we do them. And those, again, are things that are not seen. They're only seen when they're bad, right? They're only seen when there's a fight or there's an argument. Those interactions are the ones that become obvious. But in the black matter you were referring to earlier on, it's those interactions are part of that black matter. You can't see how that works. I think with the practice lens, we look at it via what we do, and then we can ask, who does it? Where is this done? And you can see not only how the practices interact, but the practitioners then in their practicing interact, still focusing on the practice. Like, how do we change the practice to get a better interaction and a better relation between these teams, these people, and so on? I think that as Agile people, or as Mark and I are, Agile coaches, for years it's been easy because, well, the very early days of doing it was easy because you were, and as my example, when we came to maturity mapping, is you were with a team and you could see the interactions that were right in front of you. You could see what they were doing. You had that bounded system where you were looking at how things that people interacted and how work would flow. But again, at a wider level of the organization, it's much, much harder to see. It just can't. I think the black matter is a really good way of putting it. It is things that are hidden. But as you're kind of, as Mark was alluding to, that is one of the key aspects, the key things to consider. And one of the key things that underlies what we do is the considering of the interactions and that those relationships and the relating that happens.
You also said earlier, just want to hawk into that, that people are resistant to change. That's actually not true, and it's not my experience. What they're resisting to is being told how to change and what to change to. Because that never works. That's the core reason they resisted to, is somebody outside who's not doing the work currently, who doesn't understand the current context, comes and tells them, now you have to do X, and they already know X won't work here, yeah? Mm-hmm. And the reason they're resisting X is because they also know, trying to get the outcome that they very well understand that person who's asking for X wants, will create a lot of difficulty for them. So what they're resisting is a particular path of change. But if you actually allow them to express, here is how we currently act in this context, and here's how your intervention will change the context. And if they have the means of making that visible, first of all, they will engage with the change constructively, because they will immediately also point out, this is how we could do differently and how what might work better, cheaper, etc. But also it allows them to have a conversation with who asked for X, where the person who asked for it isn't being confronted with resistance, but actually with said engagement. So in that example that I said about this middleware tool, the teams were able to articulate, so this is what has to change if you want to adopt that tool. Here are the outcomes that you want. Now we show you the change that we think we should engage in to achieve your outcome. And that person could see how that was easier, cheaper, quicker. So it allowed to have a conversation where that person understood, okay, I got a ball and rolling, but I need to let other people steer to where the ball is rolling. And then we get to a better outcome. So it's taking away that whole psychological element. So Simon Wardley talks about this, that he says one benefit of actually having maps is that instead of arguing about people's opinions with the propensity of becoming personal, you're mm-hmm. talking about positions on the map, yeah, and how things can move on a map, and it becomes much less personal. Mm-hmm. And so that's also how change works positively, is where people are invited into participating in the change and participating in defining the path of the change, rather than being told, yeah, you just have to do this now.
You said earlier the quote from Alicia that meaning, is, was it meaning or was it purpose that is in the meaning interaction?
Exists meaning. In the interactions of things, not the things themselves.
Yeah. So meaning exists in the interactions of things, not in the things of itself. APIs are a technology for interaction. What do these two things mean together?
Okay, so at the most prominent level, your APIs are only going to be of value if there are consumers of the APIs, mm-hmm. and the consumer is the judge of whether this is actually valuable or not. Yeah?
Or the interaction not entirely, between the consumer. But... It's the interaction between the consumer and the producer that makes it valuable. The interaction through the API.
So, yes, the value creation happens at the point of the interacting. Yeah. The consuming of an API is an interaction. Yeah. And that's the point of the value creation. But there's no value creation if you don't have consumers. Yeah.
Yes.
So at the very most prominent level, this is 101 product thinking nowadays, hopefully is. Mm-hmm. So understand your user's experience in using your API, yeah? And since most APIs are used by developer, then this ties into developer experience, which I think now is an increasingly well-understood topic, yeah? And there are people far better to talk about this than me or Chris, because we're hands-on developers anymore. So when you design your API, yeah, follow those principles first. What does a user want? Why would they interact with this? Create some hypothesis of what you believe, why they would, then go and test them with them before you build the whole bloody thing. You know, like, so don't do the I'll build it and they'll will come, which all good product people have learned. Yeah, they know that never works, or extremely lucky for it to work, and you shouldn't bank on such luck. But then the other thing is also beyond them just consuming, what kind of interactions should you enable so that actually the communication in terms of what it does, how it operates, but also how it should evolve is a product of interactions with your consumers, or depending on how your organization is set up, maybe also with your ops people. Or so look at your team boundaries, so to speak, from a social point of view, and say what interactions are actually happening through building this API that weren't there before. What can we do? What we need to have to put in place so that these interactions can flourish in a positive way, and that will also then mean that people who are interacting with you with your API can maximize benefit from it.
Thanks. There was a little bit of an oddball question. I think I want to give the floor back to you, Chris. Is there something else that you'd like to share or you'd like to still talk about? Could be something you want people to have a look at or something that we did not touch that you really wanted to talk about. I was thinking about asking you about the, because maturity mapping is about maturity of practices also, and can be about that. And that can also be useful for teams. I liked how the flow of the conversation. If you're interested in that stuff, go check out some of Chris and Mark's work. Is there something else you would like to share?
I'm not sure if we did touch on this, but I think the word maturity, mm-hmm. What does that mean? What does mature mean? There's reasons why we use it, and we've been challenged on this, but there's reasons why we use it. That's not so relevant. But the thing I think is really interesting is understanding what that maturity means. And I think we have a Miro board somewhere that we drew out all of the different, a whole bunch of different kind of stages of maturity that models have proposed over the years. But it's stages of maturity of individual development and learning, or stages of maturity of organizational practice type stuff. And we argued over this for quite a while. And we said, is the evolutionary axis that Simon described and how he describes it in his cheat sheet, is that appropriate in this context? And then I think we kind of stumbled across this phrase, or we didn't stumble across, we practiced it, we did this in maturity mapping, one of the early maturity mapping sessions, where I think we were working with a bunch of coaches, and we asked them, right, these are the practices you do. Like, I'm going to ask the same question for every practice. What does good look like? What does mature mean to you about this practice in this context? And you got some context-free answers, roundabout. I've seen it done like this before. You know, it's like, well, what does it mean here in this context? What does good look like to you? And I think that for us was a bit of a, from a practice, maturity mapping practice perspective, it was a bit of a light bulb moment, in that we realised that, the best way of which we could describe maturity of practice is maturity in the context, and what was mature in the context is what people believed good looked like in that context. Mm-hmm. And I think that for us was super important. I've kind of in recent talks described it as taste. Use that kind of lens. Is what's your taste for this? What is your experience of this? And what do you believe? What tastes good? I think it was brought to that by a talk by a gentleman called Cameron Tonkinwise. And he was talking about a little bit about Pierre Bourdieu and Pierre Bourdieu's concept of habitus, or the concept he uses called habitus, and talking about the phrase, I wouldn't be seen dead in this. He was talking about clothes and people's taste, I wouldn't be seen dead in this. And that, to the person wearing that outfit, whatever they were wearing, was probably something they were comfortable in, it's something they liked, blah. But in the context in which the other person was sitting, that wasn't what good looked like. That wasn't appropriate. I have a map kicking about somewhere on Twitter, where I mapped off a conversation with a guy on Twitter called G. Paul Hill, where the conversation was going about people wearing their pajamas going to the supermarket. I drew a map of going to the supermarket in which dressing was one of the practices in there. And my taste suggests that going to the supermarket in your pajamas, I would be seen dead in that. That's not, that's not appropriate. But the map you have there is the context in which I see it. So that practice of dressing is kind of in the immature, the kind of conceptual early stages, because dressing that way is not contextually appropriate in, from the way I see it. So I think what I think is really interesting is that the what good looks like to you is an enabler for people to express their desires and what they believe they know. And Mark said earlier on, if you want to improve things, you ask people, change happens when you go to people and say, this is the outcome we want, how can we make it better here? And people will have that that desire, that frustration with the work and the things they do, and you know, their belief in how it could be better. I think what that also does for us is lets people with different tastes observe it and say, well, I would do a practice like test-driven development in a different way. That's not the way you would do it. And have a conversation about how to develop and help either, get people get more value from the practice because maybe they have a different understanding of it in their context. Or for me to learn because, wow, I've never seen it done that way before. And that's a new learning for me. But I think that's the important thing for maturity. It's a contextual answer. It's about in this context, and the best way to understand what mature is in that context is to ask the people in the context, what does good look like to you? And we do that on a practice by practice basis. So we look at each one and not whole, what does good look like, but individually, what does good look like? And then that brings with the map, the practices mapped, get to see what all of them would look like good together. I think it's a core part of maturity mapping for me.
Yeah, so then your maturity map, the artifact that we're creating over time, becomes your contextual as in local maturity model. So an underlying principle that we're following is there are no context-free articulations of maturity. So maturity models are interesting, but more as a what Chris talked about earlier, decontextualized learnings. Yeah, people have learned things that work. And they might be observed that it works in more than one context, and they try to extract what is this self-standing thing that worked. Yeah. But when you want to make it work, you have to contextualize it again. So following maturing through a context-free maturity model will create a lot of conflicts because your context will be different in some or many ways from the guy who or the people who created that model. They were not in your context. And so a maturity map allows you to do this contextual, which also protects you then from the people and say, hey, you haven't done what the Gartner model says. For which you will have maybe very good reasons. And if you get the chance to talk about which your map enables you to, then you can show why you're not doing what Gartner says.
But it does presupposes that there is a coherence context. Because if there's difference, if the opinions about what does maturity mean for are different inside of an organization, then you've got a problem.
And or not. Well, you could have a problem, but what you could also have is a really interesting opportunity to learn.
Right.
This is how we see maturity and that's how you see maturity. Okay, are our contexts significantly different that they were both? Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to say right, but it's not right. Our articulations are both appropriate. Mm-hmm. Or is it that some team has evolved and learned beyond the kind of line of sight that question allows you to answer. So what good looks like is, it's like as far as you can see, I guess, and there's an horizon point to that. And then maybe what good looks like then extends as you get closer to the horizon, you learn more things. If you think about then one team has maybe crossed that horizon boundary, you know, they can see further. They've been in that, have had that, an experience like team A, and now team B is developed new experiences and has new ways. And that, for me, is an ideal point of learning.
It plays also to the point of taste that Chris was bringing up earlier. So one of the things, again, underlying principles of complexity is that you need multiple perspectives, differences of opinions, and in this particular case, also differences of taste, in order to actually strive and be deliberate about complexity. The map is not meant as instruction. The map is meant as shared mental model of the people who participate. And so they can have competing theories about taste of certain things, and they can make them visible on maps and say, yeah, we might not agree on what we think good looks like, so let's go and run an experiment. And at the end of it, you might come closer in your beliefs about what good looks like, and you're more certain about your maturity model for this particular things, or you might discover, hey, we found even more things that we need to go observe, investigate. So you run more experiments, it informs new experiments.
Why do you think that Warnley maps have this inevitable evolution dimension? So like there's the one big arrow of time. you know, everything becomes a utility, kind of that kind of mindset. Is that purely a function of the capitalist society that we live in, or is there something else, or is there some bigger truth behind that is not purely part of the capitalist context?
So Simon says, like, it's everything evolves through supply and demand. Is that mm-hmm. that connects the phrase he uses?
What I think is interesting is if you watch Marx talk about ironing, or talk a little video mm-hmm. does about ironing, that evolution, is that a supply and demand evolution?
Nope.
That's a learning evolution. That's a, you know, it's a, you know, we want to have a better outcome. So the material evolution happens through both deliberately and also through sort of exaptation. I think some of the things you described, the crimpers on the shirts or something, and yep. hair, I think you used that. So yeah, that's really interesting. I don't know. I don't think that's universally true. I think it's a really interesting model, but I don't think it's universally true.
So first of all, Simon articulates the evolutionary axis the way he does based on material things, maybe slightly meta-material things. So we could say products or material products, but we can also think about services. Yeah, they seem to adhere to the same principles. That's different from practices. So if we look at the artifacts of on my ironing map, yeah, the artifacts follow Simon's evolution. You can see how things become more commoditized, etc., in every step. To the extent, yes, so you end up with the electric iron that has settings for all sorts of things that encapsulate practices. But if you, so practice theory in that sense gives you a broad lens on what's driving. So I do not subscribe that, you know, societal or cultural or any of these kind of evolutions are driven by supply and demand and that sort of thing, or even competition. Which is another underlying principle for worldly mapping. So the reason we're using maps is essentially because Simon has given us some useful rules for mapping, even if you're not doing his strategic form of worldly maps, yeah? And those rules we found very applicable. The evolutionary axis in practices is on one side, the much more simple things, and then on the other side, the much more complex things. So the more simple thing is that it gives the team an opportunity to talk about improvement. Yeah, they literally can say, we need to do certain things that we're either not doing yet at all or we do them badly. Yeah, and how can we guide the activity that we do so that we start improving those things? So the movement from left to right is literally just an improvement move, yeah? That's a simple thing. As teams get better at practices, also their articulation what good looks like changes. Yeah, so it's not a static thing that you say, okay, we start mapping on day X and we articulate what good looks like, and then on day Y you're on the right hand side. What you then often see when you actually work with teams is that their articulation of what good looks like evolves just as much. So we use the map literally just as a conversation tool. Mm-hmm. It's a, how do you visualize practices in a sense that they can act, that the interaction and the integration of practice and how they influence each other, how you can have conversation about it. That was Chris's insight, that he just said, oh yeah, if we put this on a working map, we have it gives us a conversational tool. It gives us ways to express some of the concepts that we already used for fostering such conversations, etc., makes them very visible in an elegant way. But then there's the more complex aspect that you could apply is, so an underlying principle of worldly map, even in the product design, product service space, is that as they move to the right, our ability to extract value from having the thing, no, goes up. We can create more and more value. In the whole, yeah. So in the as whole. A society. Mm-hmm. So if you think about electric outlets, yeah, what value does it have to society if only people who are billionaires could afford them? Yeah. nobody cares. The stuff that only billionaires can afford, we might be envious about it, but it doesn't add to the society. When it becomes a commodity, so it's in every household, mm-hmm. or in every room multiple times, suddenly it enables an awful lot of things.
But it's a double thing, because through commoditization, you can extract more value in the volume, but it's in the, like, the value when you're interfacing with customers is on the left, is when there is more variety in what you're producing. So
you get less value as a producer of it.
You can get less value as a producer.
So you are on the left on the map when you discover new valuable things, yeah? But a lot of value comes from the reliability of the ubiquity of things. So public transport is a commodity.
But it
is the commodity and making it a commodity that adds value to a society as a whole. Okay, so now we can question that public transport is that valuable given how it destroys the planet. But it has enabled us to take jobs that we couldn't take before, meet people that we couldn't meet before, go to cultural events that we couldn't go before. So making commodity has enriched the society as a whole.
That's looking through the societal lens at value in this framework. But if you look at the producer of a unit of something, a single unit of a commodity, you get a lot less value that you can capture from it. Even if we're not thinking about capturing and value-based selling and so on, even if we're not thinking capitalistic, this layeredness of how technologies stack on top of each other, you see that the lower layers will be on the right, but then as you get closer to the customer, to the people that are actually interfacing with whatever you're producing with that, you will have something custom that's built with that to address the specific needs of that person in their specific context. So as you go right, it becomes more context-free. As you go left, it's not only less mature, it can also be more contextualized, at least in the evolution, if the axis is commoditization.
So if a thing is novel, think any kind of gadget or blah, 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 if it's really novel, yeah, usually initially the usage, so using it is clumsy. And the clumsiness is overcome by the enthusiast who already sees the value. They're willing to invest more learning and figuring out their own practices and using the things, yeah, and making work for them. Because they're early adopters, they see value before other people see it.
But there's the economy of differentiation. That's the one. So you have the economy of the scaling, there's also the economy of differentiation. And to increase the variety of what you are producing, you almost inevitably have to go away from the mass production, unless it's like empty variety. You can add some flavor, you can add a color, but it's all the same stuff. That's not real variety. It's something I'm struggling with, because if you don't want to be a commodity provider in the market, you have to somehow differentiate yourself. Yeah. And that almost inevitably means that you can't be on the right side. You can't be on the industrialized side.
Your product or your service can't, yeah?
Yeah.
But the practices that you're using in order to produce that, they still need to, I would argue, even be more mature. Take custom guitars. The reason people buy custom guitars is because they have some things that they can't get from the commodity guitar, yeah? They say, I want something specifically the way I play, the way I want to play, that I'm not getting from an existing guitar. They go to a custom guitar builder who, I would argue, the practices of guitar building, he's probably better than almost everybody who works on a commodity product, yeah?
Yes.
So they're more mature.
Is it that social practices are like on three dimensions? So there's meaning, there's a
multidimensional, of course. There's other aspects too, but ultimately, so we always say that, you know, don't take the map too literal. It's a conversation. It's visualizing things is ways is a way in which humans can make sense of complex contexts together. Yeah, how we can bring all our viewpoints together, and helps us exchange our viewpoints so that we, as a collective, you know, arrive at something that's bigger than what we would have been able to do ourselves. It is not it's not a recipe, and it's not a rule, and it's a conversation. So the core thing Simon says why he came up with maps was to create contextual awareness. We're just extending this into the realm of what you do, not just what you have.
And the thing that I'm fascinated by is if you're doing the contrarian strategic. So as a strategist, I like thinking, like, what's the contrarian thing? So if everybody's trying to build industrialized products that are standardized, is there value in not doing that and going the other route? And there definitely is in the material aspect. Like, we can see that, like, you have the Starbucks of the world, and then you have the bespoke, super special light roast stuff. I wonder if there's some, well, I think it's taking it too far. No, this is a really awesome conversation. Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed it.
I hope we were able to express, like, the value of maturity mapping and social practice theory and kind of like your lens that you're bringing to the world and that you're trying to help teams with, so that people that are curious can learn a bit more about that. If somebody wants to learn more about Contextualize, because that's actually the company that you both work for, how can they find out more?
Contextualize.co is a website, or you can get either of us independently on Twitter.
And is it the US spelling, or is it the
British
spelling? British spelling.
British spelling.
And I like a less context or a more context-free version is probably maturitymapping.com, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's all in one word.
And if you search for us, maturity mapping on YouTube, there's a load of talks. I did one last week, I think, for a Worldly Mapping conference, which is up there now.
It was a lovely talk.
I took quite a practical slant to it and talked through the steps we follow to maturity map, so it might be a good one for people to start with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. This episode of the Resilience Podcast was brought to you by Pronovix and Contextualize. You can learn more about our companies at pronovix.com and maturitymapping.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, be sure to mind the context.